Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, for a rare change, I actually came up with a history topic which I wanted to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about the subject of banned books. And there's a couple of reasons.
Hold on, everybody. Wait, listen. Here we are. Here, I'm sitting down. Chink. I've got my gin and tonic here. I'm putting my sunglasses on. I am relaxed as Greg educates me. Over to you, Greg.
Well, I kind of got this from a couple of reasons. One, and we just mentioned this off air, we actually had a bit of a discussion about what the topic actually was this week. There'd been some miscommunication. But one of these is the famous scenes of book burning. And I know that Jem and I have talked about book burning before, and we've kind of said how there's this weird situation where you can hear all of the crimes of everything that happened in Nazi Germany and everything, and so many horrible crimes done to people, and yet one of the most dramatic scenes that makes me just catch my breath every time is when you hear about, when you see about these mass book burnings, and the fact that there they were burning books in order to try and control and take away history that they didn't want known, and all these different reasons for burning books. And this got me thinking and got me starting to have a little bit of a look at the world of banning books. And I suddenly started to find out more and more that, you know, this isn't something obviously that's specific to Nazi Germany. There have been all sorts of books banned for all sorts of reasons. You get books banned for political reasons. You get books banned for reasons of decency. You get books banned for because of what the information they contain. One book that's banned in a lot of the world today, for example, is the Anarchist Cookbook. It gives a lot of information about building bombs and other things you don't want. You know, obviously there are situations where people like George Orwell found it difficult to get Animal Farm published, and that has been banned in various places. And then you get some weird ones. For example, and this is my third example before I hand it over to Jim. For example, in the Hunan province of China from 1931, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was banned from
That's
sale.
That's a good find. Well done. Yep.
Well, yeah, I was quite pleased with that one. The reason that one was banned was because General Ho Xin, who was the censor at that point in time, and I apologise for the pronunciation, he didn't like the fact that in that book, animals were acting, they were anthropomorphised, they were acting as people, and he was worried that this could be children would read these books and think, oh, hold on, we should treat animals exactly the same as people, and he thought that would lead to disastrous results. So I don't know what he would make of Peppa Pig or anything else like that. But yeah, so books are banned for all sorts of reasons, and I'm someone who's big on freedom of speech and everything else, and so I wanted to kind of just explore the topic of banning books and whether or not historically there's ever a good reason for it, and how far we go down this rabbit hole. Little Alice in Wonderland reference there is yet to be seen. So, Jim, your first thoughts?
Well, say what you want about the Anarchist Cookbook, but their cheese souffle is something to die for. I've actually seen a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook.
You see, if
Cookbook,
Jim doesn't have to actually work on coming up with the topics and he sits back and relaxes, it gives him more time to prepare and advance some extra jokes for the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Actually, I'm going to go back to your comment there about book burning. And if you like, this is where... oh my goodness, there's a sneak in here for Neon, my podcast about pop culture here, because I'm actually going to mention, well, one bit of pop culture and a fictional book, which I've written. I'm not going to call that pop culture. It's not popular enough to be culture. But anyway, in my book, Silent Crossroads, a lot of the action happens in the interwar years. And you have this British guy living in Germany, in Hanover, and you start seeing the creeping in of the fascism and obviously the rise of Hitler. And what I did is, in that particular scene, while it's fictional, I actually read a number of accounts about book burnings, and you know, I tried to show you the horror of it and make sure I listed some of the names that were actually banned, including Jules Verne. Now, you'd think, what's he done that was wrong? You know, he's a seminal sci-fi author. But, of course, some of his images of warfare were very negative. You know, Eric Maria remarks, All Quiet on the Western Front was banned by the Germans because it didn't show World War I to be particularly fun. Well, not by the Germans, but by the Nazis, I should say. So, you know, they banned German works as well, even if they had nothing to do with Jews or having, if you like, contentious information in it. Turned out World War I was bad. So yes, I portray that. But the important thing is I portray it in the correct year, 1933. It was one of the first things the Nazis did. It wasn't one of the last things they did before World War II. So I want you to bear that in mind, because if you were to watch Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, now there's an awful lot of hatred towards Crystal Skull, and yes, that is definitely the worst. But prior to that, some people thought that Crusade was the best one, and I would say that's the weakest of the original trilogy. I think actually it's a slow decline. Raiders of the Lost Ark's perfect. You've then got Temple of Doom, which is pretty good. But then you've got Last Crusade, which is a bit... It's got great interplay with Sean Connery. And then you've got Crystal Skull, which is like, why bother?
Well, then they bring it back with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Steven Spielberg has announced that his next movie will be the fifth Indiana Jones film, and it will still star Harrison Ford. So, whatever. Well, you know... You know, I hope it's good, but I don't know. Anyway, but my point is this. That film, very specifically, is set in 1939. And there's this marvelous scene where Indy ends up having to go to Berlin to get his dad's diary. And they're showing a book burning. And it's 6 years too late. It's already happened. That's already been a thing. And there's this hilarious scene where Indy bumps up against Adolf Hitler, who signs this book, he thinking it's sort of Mein Kampf or something like that. And indeed, Mein Kampf was a book that has been banned as well. You know, if it's written by one of the biggest mass murderers in history, probably it's not a book you want to be generally circulated. So, you know, with the Nazis, you got them banning books, but some of the Nazi books ended up being banned. I think you can tell which side I'm on that one. But just a little fun fact is the guy who plays Hitler in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade also played an Imperial officer who gets choked to death by Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back. So he had a bit of a renaissance in the 1980s of playing bad guys in big, big movies, but he was on Grange Hill. He was Mr. Bronson on Grange Hill, and he was always a tough teacher. So, he fitted perfectly as both Hitler and an Imperial officer of the Galactic Empire. But I just love that little fact. So there you go. Slight sidebar there, but it does show you, there's a quote, I don't know who said it, but whoever said it, I agree with you, which is simply, no good can come from burning books. And, you know, when you're looking at the Nazis, it generally, whether you disagree with the information inside books or not, don't destroy information. It's just a bad thing. Of course, nowadays it has less power. All this stuff is now digitized and it's now out there on the internet, and it's actually very hard to destroy information. But one of the horrors of when you've got like the great fire in the great library in Alexandria, or what Greg was alluding to, when the Mongols destroyed Baghdad in the 1250s, and all they did was destroy books after book. You just know that there's information in those books, in those tomes, in those papyruses, like in Alexandria, that have been lost forever. And we would be better off today if we knew about that information.
It's one of those strange things. Once you start trying to destroy any information, even if it's information that's provably wrong, you give that information sort of in its way more power as well. One of the funniest things from the world of magic that I ever heard is, because obviously lots of people, they come up with magic tricks. Some of these tricks get published very secretly. Some of the secrets of magic tricks get sold for a lot of money. But there are also magic magazines. And, you know, every month or so in a lot of the magic magazines, somebody will come up with a new trick and it will be published in the magic magazine and everybody can then read it. And one of the really interesting things I find about that is those ones that keep their tricks really, really secretive, when other people see this trick, they see it secret, they really try and get hold of that, and they try and come up with their own versions of it, that they'll buy it. Whereas what I have heard is the best way to keep a magic trick secret, the best way to keep the method secret and stop other people performing it, is to publish it in a magic magazine and let everybody know how it's done. Because all the professional magicians, of course, go, oh, if it's in the magazine, everyone will be doing it. And so, in fact, nobody ends up doing it. So that's sort of one of the things about actually let information out there. Just because information is out there doesn't mean that...
A case of hiding in plain sight, isn't it?
Hiding in plain sight, exactly. Or, you know, you've got people who are sort of like Elon Musk with the Tesla cars and the Tesla charging stations, who came up with the idea that if he made the way his charging stations public domain, he made the technology of that and released it to the public, well, then everyone's going to use his style of charging station, which is what you need. You need everyone using the right style of charger, and you need that to spread in order for your cars to be used. So there's something to be said about not containing information. But we've talked about sort of book burning and trying to destroy information. But I also want to look at the world of banned books from the idea of trying to not destroy the information, but to control its release. And I think arguably the most famous book in the world, a lot of people don't realise that there are a lot of bans in place around the Bible. And I'm not talking about the fact that, yes, there are parts of the world today where Bibles are actually banned, but historically, and I've actually gone through and I've actually got sources for this one, Jem. You'll be very impressed with me for this one.
Wow.
Because I actually found some websites, in fact, quite a lot of websites, refuting the information I'm about to give you. Because there was a point where it was the Bible was only supposed to be read in the church by the people of the church. There, you were not supposed to read the Bible on your own. You were not supposed to have your own copies of the Bible. And most importantly, for a long, long time, the Bible wasn't translated into languages like English because they didn't want the populace to be able to read their own Bible. So while the book itself was not banned in the sense of they're going to destroy all the copies, the book was banned from the point of view of, we don't want you reading it. We want to read it and tell you what it says. And just to clarify, because as soon as I started looking into this, I saw that there are groups out there saying, oh, no, this is a lie. This is conspiracy to try and make the church sound bad. The earliest one I found, the decree of the Council of Toulouse in 1229 said, we prohibit also that the laity should be permitted to have the books of the Old or New Testament, but we most strictly forbid their having any translation of these books. So that's a way of allowing the book to exist, but banning copies of the book in such a way that you can really control the information.
Okay, I agree, and I want to tell you perhaps about the... You know, the one that I remember from my university days and just the sheer irony of this. So John Milton, if you don't know who he is, he was like an English philosopher in the 1600s. And he wrote various different books and treatises. And this is technically an essay rather than a book. But and I'm now going to mangle the title of it because, of course, it's in Latin. All good books about philosophy and mathematics have to, of course, have a Latin name. But Areopagitica. I believe is the way you say it. I could well be wrong. But the point is, he was writing this at the time of the Commonwealth. You know, you have Oliver Cromwell. And it was a hugely impassioned speech about free speech, about how things should not be banned or censored. And obviously against the very puritanical rulers of that time, that was pushing against. It was seen as very controversial. So, somewhat ironically, it got banned. And look, you're right, there are sort of silly situations like the Alice in Wonderland one, which I didn't know. That's a great find, by the way. But then there's also ones where, you know, it's the ideas that are dangerous. Although I am going to mention, you've got A Brave New World, which is Aldous Huxley. That's quite a famous one. And similarly, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Brave New World was banned for many decades in Ireland. Lady Chatterley Lover was banned for a number of decades in Britain because they were a bit, how can I put this politely, racy. They were quite intimate, and they were seen as shocking to the world, which, quite frankly, if you read them now, there's not a lot there that's going to offend. I wouldn't let a 10-year-old read them, but... Yeah, so it can be pushing against society in all kinds of ways, quite often for good ways, like, you know, the in the case of John Milton, you know, he's having a debate there about freedom of speech, and someone like, I've already mentioned, All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, that was an anti-war novel, and that's an important thing to remember. But sometimes they can be silly too, or there's a lot of politics going on at that point, which is why people are interfering with the spread of information, is what this ultimately all boils down to.
And it does make a difference on who's doing the banning as well, of course, and exactly what the ban is in place and how it's been done. I mean, you talk about something like Alice in Wonderland or some of the others. One of the other books that I found that was banned in its way was the Canterbury Tales, which was not banned entirely, but you were not allowed to send it using US mail in the late 1800s. They actually had a federal anti-obscenity act, and because of that, a number of books, including the Canterbury Tales, you weren't allowed to send or receive through the post because they contained obscene, filthy, or inappropriate material. Now, we're talking there about a book that a lot of people these days study in school. You know, it's part of a lot of things, and like you say, when we read ones like that, it's very easy to think, oh well, that's a bit silly, it's you know and I'm absolutely fine, let's be clear, with sort of private institutions and things. If that was, you know, sort of, I don't know, whatever the local delivery company is, if they say, well, we don't take this, we don't take that, you know, if you have, you know, sort of a religious delivery company, as it were, and they want to say. But the trouble comes, as you say, when we start getting government stepping in and telling people what they can and they can't read, or, again, the church, where it had that huge amount of power, stepping in and telling people you can or you can't read this, because there are still a lot of places, and sort of a lot of governments have recommended reading this and things they won't allow to happen in certain places. But one of the ones with me was, I believe it's the American Library Service does actually control which books will be allowed in the library. And the thing is, they're public libraries. Surely they're one of the ones that should be helping get information to people rather than the other way around.
I would argue there that that's probably just down to sheer quantity of books. Like, do we need another book on the Pacific Campaign, 1941 to 1945? of course, a position like that could be abused. And if I disagree with something like the theory of evolution, which has been banned in various different states at various different times in America. I'll give him a pass on something like that. But if you like, my little story that I wanted to throw into this one is going back to when Jem was 13 years old. Now, Greg, a bit of a stab in the dark on this one. As a kid, did you read Final Fantasy books or Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Not Final Fantasy, but I did do the old Choose Your Own Adventure books. And actually, I read one quite recently. Because I don't know, do you know Neil Patrick Harris?
Yeah,
he wrote his autobiography.
Oh, really? That's amazing. Oh, I'm buying that right now. That is amazing. Oh, well done, Neil Patrick Harris. If for some reason you ever hear this, you have just blown my mind, and you've just got another sale. Oh, that is a genius idea. Yes, more autobiography should be done that way, in my opinion. But anyway... the original ones were created by Steve Jackson and Ian Livingston, and these names may mean something to you, Greg, but maybe to the listeners. Things like Warlock of Firetop Mountain, Death Trap Dungeon, City of Thieves. There were just loads and loads of these Choose Your Own Adventure books that were very, very hot in the 1980s. And anyway, in my local newspaper, a local vicar decided to go on a campaign to stop this twisted filth from infecting the brains of the young, and wanted to ban these books. And I read it, and I was so incensed that my mother said, well, why don't you write a rebuttal to the newspaper? And so I tried really hard, and I got my mum to help me with it, to make it, you know, as polish it as much as you possibly could. And what I did was I actually pulled some quotes, because basically he was saying, you know, listen to this moment in this book, and oh, isn't that bloody, and oh, look at this, and isn't that disgusting, and people are reading all this stuff all the time. And the implication was that basically anybody reading it was a delinquent, and I wasn't. I was a very nice, well-behaved 13-year-old boy, and, you know, fast-forwarding some 30-odd years, I'm married, I have two children, I pay my taxes, I love my wife, I love my kids. I'm not perfect, but I'm certainly not a homicidal maniac, which is allegedly what I would have turned into with those books. So I picked some particularly gory bits. I got it wrong. I thought it was from the Bible. It's actually from the Apocrypha, because we happen to have a copy of the Bible which had the Apocrypha in the back of it. For those of you who don't know, that's the bit of the Bible that got made up in the Middle Ages and sat there as being a genuine part of the Bible for a couple of centuries until somebody went, hang on, this isn't in any of the early copies. take that out. So an apocryphal story comes from the Apocrypha, which is just made up. But anyway, the point is it's not considered particularly dangerous. So I chose some bits of that. I also chose some bits from the Odyssey, because I was reading that at school in English, I hasten to add. And there was a wonderful scene where they slay the Cyclops by heating up a huge burning log and stabbing it into his eye with it sizzling. It was a wonderfully graphic depiction of slaying this giant monster. So I put all those together. I put those quotes together, and then at the end going, well, that's from the Bible. That's from Odysseus, which is, you know, the Odyssey. So, you know, these are sort of everywhere and considered acceptable. Why are those acts of violence fine, whereas these acts of violence are seen as tainting and corrupting human beings? And actually, we went backwards and forwards a few letters, because the newspaper did publish it. It was the letter of the week with my rebuttal, and we went backwards and forwards. We basically both had two rounds of arguing, and the newspaper printed all of them. And I was so proud. I remember when my mother came in, because she was going down to the news agency, did they print it? And I remember her coming in, and I said, did they print it? And she just grinned at me, and then I realised she was holding a stack of newspapers, because she was going to cut out those and send them to all the members of the family. So, sure. And I've still got copies of them there. But the point is, almost anybody can be offended by anything. And I think that in the modern world, I've recently been hanging around a bunch of sort of university students and some of the lecturers, and there's sort of this moaning of everybody is so hypersensitive about everything. And whereas, yes, we shouldn't live in a sexist, racist world, and sexism and racism is appalling and homophobia is awful. I mean, all these things I agree with. But also at some point, you have to have more than paper skin, a paper skin covering to your morality and your feelings. Sometimes you just have to let it slide. Or sometimes you just have to understand that you're offended, but everybody else isn't, so just suck it up. But, you know, if you're in a position of power, or maybe you've got a political agenda, you can start hammering some in really innocuous stuff just because, ...
Well, I think, Jim, we're actually moving towards the end of the podcast. So what I will say is one little piece of information I found about the English censorship is that the good news on the English censorship on that side of things is the last book to be officially censored under the Obscene Publications Act was actually way back in 1992. There's a book called David Britton called Lord Horror. That was the last book that actually in the United Kingdom got officially governmentally banned for obscenity. So these days, you know, sort of...
Do you happen to know, was that violence or was that naughtiness?
Naughtiness, I believe. Okay. Yes, okay. I believe it came under the Great British Naughtiness Law.
The Great British Naughtiness Act of 1807. Okay.
Yes, so that is the last time that a book was actually banned for obscenity in this country, which is quite good to know, really, because it means I can get back onto my major tome of... naughty stuff from Greg Chapman. You know, that's going to be my next major book. So anyway, Jim, we're running out of time.
Confessions of a Juggler. Right, well, we're definitely going down a cul-de-sac. Let's quickly bring it back up. Look, do you know what? We started, it was so good at the beginning, Greg. We were talking about literature and everything. I've managed to get John Milton, a philosopher, in, and here we are just giggling about naughty stuff. Oh, well, I guess that's condensed history gems in a nutshell.
Well, do you have something you want to plug just before we finish up?
Well, I think I have to say this now because I've written books. None of them have been banned anywhere that I'm aware of. Maybe I'd get more coverage and uptick on sales if they got banned somewhere. So I've got 7 published through Ambly Publishing. I've got 2 self-published. Have a look on something like Amazon. You'll get a full list. If you don't like Amazon, go to a bookshop and say, hey, look, there's this author, Jem Deduccio. What has he written? Or indeed, you can go onto the Condensed Histories website and you can get a list of my books there. But please have a look. There's kind of something for everybody. There's even one non-fiction book. Already mentioned it, Silent Crossroads. Check something out.
And yeah, and I'm going to say I have actually started work on series 2 of The Last Airship. We've got scripts and everything else underway, plus a few other projects, which means I have started doing a little bit of funding for that again. So if you're interested in helping out basically all my podcasts, all my shows, and The Last Airship series 2, then do go over and check out patreon.com/GregChapman. And just have a little look and see what's going on over there. But for
I do hope that you're not going to call it The Second to Last Airship.
Oh, dear. No, I'm not. It's just going to be The Last Airship 2. I'm not being clever with it.
Even laster.
Anyway, sorry. That is all we've got time for today. So please, our final plug, as always, we've got Jem's other podcast, Neon. We've got my other podcast, Greg Chapman's Tales from the Road. And we've got the Condensed History Gems podcast. All of these are available on whatever podcast app you're listening on. And if you could take 2 minutes out of your day to go and write a review for one or all of those podcasts, and most importantly, just go and let somebody else know that you listen to them and that you enjoy them. That does us a great deal of help. But for now, thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deduccio.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And goodbye. And take care.